Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the minor prophets of the Old Testament. So grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McClarty.
For the folks on the internet, there was no message last week due to a technicality because I technically fell down some stairs and hurt myself. But because nothing was broken, here I am. I'm like a weeble. Weebles wobble, but they get back up again. Tonight, I'm fighting the onset of a cold, so you'll just have to excuse me as I snuffle my way through this lesson tonight. My intention tonight is to get into Zechariah 13, but before we do that, we're going to go to the book of Obadiah. So see if you can find Obadiah. If you have an ink and paper Bible, Obadiah is right before the book of Jonah. And sometimes Jonah's easier to find. The name Obadiah means the servant or the slave of Yah. And he is also one of these 12 minor prophets. His particular prophecy is actually the shortest book in the Bible. Some people think it's Jude, but Jude has 24 verses. Obadiah only has 21. And it's believed that this particular short prophecy was delivered around the time of the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem around 587 BC. His particular prophecy, and the reason I want to look at it tonight, is against the Edomites. The Edomites are the descendants of Esau. And the reason that he is prophesying against the Edomites is because of their rejoicing over the destruction of Jerusalem, and also for Edom's sins against Israel and Judah. Now, the descendants of Edom being descendants of Esau, the Edomites being descendants of Esau, is also a fulfillment of what we read in Malachi 1, 2, and 3, that Paul also picks up in Romans 9, 13, that Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. Obadiah is going to say essentially that, because in the midst of declaring destruction against the Edomites, he is also going to declare God's faithfulness to Israel and the restoration that is coming. His message is very much in league with what we've been reading out of Zechariah. If you don't know the story of Abraham's son, Isaac. Isaac and Rebekah had twin boys. Those twin boys were Jacob and Esau. And even while they were in the womb, God told Rebekah that the older was going to serve the younger. And then the story is that as he was returning to the field, very, very hungry, Esau saw his brother Jacob with a mess of pottage, is the King James phraseology, basically a pot of soup. And Esau said, "Give me something to eat or I'll die." And Jacob said to him, "Well, give me your birthright." Esau figured, "Well, what good is my birthright if I die?" And so he agreed to give him the birthright. Jacob, whose name means heel catcher, we have often said he is a supplanter, he is a heel catcher. That name was given to him because when his brother was born first, he was clutching the heel of his brother and then ultimately did get the promise of the firstborn from his brother and then got the blessing from his father as Rebekah and he pulled a bit of chicanery and he pretended to be his brother. So my point for tonight is that Jacob and Esau are brothers. They do have a common father. And that's going to come up here in Obadiah. God is going to blame Edom for the way that they celebrated the downfall of Jacob, and Jacob is their brother. And so that just amplifies the guilt that Edom had. Edom itself was a nation that was neighboring Israel. And Obadiah declares that Edom will be judged for its actions, particularly its gloating over the fall of Jerusalem and its hostility toward Israel. And the prophecy emphasizes Edom's pride and Edom's arrogance and their confidence in their fortified location, because Edom itself was up on the side of mountains and rocky sides. They lived in caves, but they were also quite wealthy up there. They felt that their fortified city was essentially impregnable, and therefore they became arrogant and prideful. And God is going to mention that in Obadiah's prophecy, that despite the fact that they have set themselves on high, that God is going to take them down. And as I mentioned, while focusing on Edom's judgment, that prophecy is also going to include a promise of restoration and a renewed kingdom for Israel under God's rule. So what I want to remind you of first is that 2 weeks ago in Zechariah 12, verse 6, one of the predictions about Israel is that in that day, I will make the clans of Judah like a fire pot among pieces of wood and a flaming torch among sheaves, so that they will consume on the right hand and on the left all the surrounding peoples, while the inhabitants of Jerusalem again dwell on their own sites in Jerusalem. So the same way that God made a differentiation between Israel and the nations around them and is going to use Israel as a fire pot among pieces of wood and a flaming torch among sheaves, Obadiah is going to pick up that same language. But he's going to center in on who it is that is going to be destroyed, and that is particularly Edom. So let's start reading at the very beginning of the book of Obadiah. Let me get this lozenge out of my mouth. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from Yahweh, and an envoy or a messenger has been sent among the goy, among the nations, saying, arise and let us go against her for battle. So essentially what that first verse is telling us is that God himself is calling together Gentile nations in order to war against Edom to bring about the destruction of Edom that God is going to predict here through Obadiah. We've heard a report from Yahweh, and there is a messenger that's been sent out to the goy, the Gentile nations, saying, arise, let us go against her, against Edom, for battle. Behold, I will make you small or insignificant among the nations, and you are greatly despised. Now, the nations that actually ended up having a part in destroying the Edomites included the Nabataeans, the Jews later on under John Hyrcanus, that was around 152 to 63 BC, and then ultimately Rome, and that was the destruction of Edom as a nation, as a powerful entity. And here God said that that was going to happen, that the Gentile nations were going to go to battle against Edom and make them small, make them insignificant among the nations, and make them greatly despised. Verse 3, and the reason for that is, the arrogance of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in the loftiness of your dwelling places, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? And though you build high like an eagle, though you set your nests among the stars, From there, I will bring you down, declares Yahweh. Geographically, historically, that's true, that the Edomites did build their city and their surrounding dwelling places in the rocks, in the caves, in the dens, up on the side of mountains in order to protect themselves from their enemies. And yet God says, because you're rich, because you have made your money both through trade and through attacking other people and taking their wealth, the arrogance of your heart has fooled you into believing that your high places, that your rocky dwellings are going to protect you, are going to save you. You build high like an eagle, but I'm going to bring you down. Verse 5 then says, if thieves came to you, if robbers by night, oh, how you will be ruined. Would they not steal only until they had enough? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave you some gleanings? It was very common among people then. If they gleaned a harvest, they would leave behind some for the poor. And what God is getting at here is, even if thieves and robbers break in and rob you, they're only going to take what they want. They're still going to leave you something. And grape gatherers will leave something behind when they glean. But God is saying, but that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to take it all. I'm going to wipe you out completely. Oh, how Esau will be ransacked. Notice here that he went from calling them Edom and Edomites to referring to them as Esau, because they are the descendants of Esau. By the way, is it worth pointing out that the Middle Eastern nations over there, the Arab nations in the Middle East, are the descendants of Esau and the Edomites. And to this very day, they continue to fight against the Jews. And politically, people struggle with why this happens. President after president after president has tried to bring peace to the Middle East. Each one gets short-term deals, but ultimately they're in vain, because this problem is a biblical problem that harkens all the way back to the fact that they have a common father who had the Abrahamic promise, and so they each believe that they own the land in that area, which is why they want to drive Israel into the sea and overtake that whole land, and they want to ultimately be rid of Israel. And that goes back again to biblical explanations. You can only understand world geopolitics if you understand the Bible. Esau will be ransacked, and his hidden treasures will be searched out. All the men who are allied with you, who are on your side, who are making deals with you, who will protect you, will send you forth to the border, and the men at peace with you will deceive you and overpower you. They who eat your bread will set an ambush for you, and there is no understanding in him. Really interesting phraseology, because the Edomites used to boast in the fact that they had some of the wisest men in the world. Because they had money and power, they had wise men among them, and yet God says that there's really no understanding in Edom. They really don't understand it. They don't get it. And in fact, the very people who they are trusting, the very nations who they think are going to protect them, are going to be the very ones who ultimately turn on them, deceive them, and overpower them. For instance, back in the late 6th, early 5th century, the Nabataeans went to the Edomites, who then took them in for a banquet. But at that banquet, once they were welcomed inside the Edomite territory, those Nabataeans turned against the Edomites and actually killed all their guard. So this is an example of the kind of thing that God is talking about here. that even though they are trusting in the other Gentile nations to protect them, it is those same Gentile nations driven by God and the messenger of God collecting the nations to fight against Edom that is ultimately going to bring about their downfall, which, by the way, historically did happen. Verse 8, "Will I not on that day, declares Yahweh, destroy wise men from Edom and destroy understanding from the mountain of Esau? Then your mighty men will be dismayed, O Teman, one of the chief cities, so that everyone may be cut off from the mountain of Esau by slaughter." Okay, now this is quite a prediction for such a short book that the Edomites, that the descendants of Esau, are ultimately going to be cut off entirely by other Gentile nations. But here's the reasoning that God gives. I know on Sunday I said that one of the characteristics of God, the real God, the maker of heaven and earth, that no other leader of any respected organized religion in the history of the world can boast, is that God can tell you what's going to happen, and he can tell you what has happened, and then he can tell you why it happened. And here's the reason for what's going to happen to them, starting in verse 10. "Because of violence to your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. To this day, as I just said, people are still fighting in the Middle East about that plot of land that was given to Abraham in perpetuity. Abraham was told, through Isaac shall your seed be called, and then through Isaac, through Jacob, ultimately to the 12 tribes, that is the seed of Abraham that possesses the Abrahamic covenant. And yet before Isaac was born, there was also Ishmael. And Abraham loved Ishmael, but the Ishmaelites are the forerunners of the Esauites and the Edomites. These are all family related to the patriarchs of the Old Testament, who also feel like they should possess the land because they have the same genealogical pedigree. They can point back to the same forefathers and then say those promises belong to us. And so while the Esauites, while the modern Arabs, while the Edomites, while they want to destroy Israel, God said here, ultimately you're the ones who are going to be destroyed, and it is Israel that is going to be established. And why? Because of the violence you did to your brother Jacob. So you will be covered with shame, and you will be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried away Jacob's wealth, and foreigners entered his gate, and cast lots for Jerusalem, you too were as one of them. So God is holding them nationally guilty for the way that they reacted to the downfall of their brother Jacob. As the other Gentile nations were destroying Jerusalem and scattering Israel, Edom was right there among them. You too were as one of them. Do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. And do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. By the way, could we apply that to the modern church? And say, you know, you better be careful. That whole thing that Paul picks up about the wild olive branches shouldn't be boasting against the natural branches. Here is yet again an example of God holding Gentiles guilty for boasting against Israel, because God's ultimate plan, as we're going to see from Obadiah and as we're going to see from Zechariah tonight, his ultimate plan is the restoration of Israel. So if you were hoping for or betting on the destruction, the dispersion of Israel and God being finished with them, you're on the wrong side of prophecy. And so then God is against that. Do not gloat over your brother's day of misfortune, and do not rejoice over the sons of Judah in the day of their destruction. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their disaster. Yes, you do not gloat over their calamity in the day of their disaster. And do not loot their wealth in the day of their disaster. Do not stand at the fork in the road to cut down their fugitives. And do not imprison their survivors in the day of their distress. All things that the Edomites actually did do from the day that the Israelites set up camp and lived in that portion of land that was given to them by a continual covenant from God, the Edomites have continued to be a thorn in their side. And yet Obadiah, while seeing the destruction of Jerusalem, is telling the Edomites, these are still your brethren. Do not be gloating over the fact or enriching yourself over the fact that they have fallen. Get on God's side in all of this, because this, starting at verse 15, is what God has planned for Israel. So make sure you're on God's side when it comes to thinking about the future for Israel. That's true back here in Obadiah. I would say it's just as true today. Verse 15, for the day of the Lord, there's that phraseology, the day of God's judgment, when he's going to punish Israel, but then restore Israel, for the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations, because it is the time of Jacob's trouble, but then it is going to branch out into all those surrounding nations. For the day of the Lord draws near on all the nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. The same way that you were destroying your brethren, they will destroy you. Your own dealings will return on your own head. Because just as you drank on my holy mountain, all the nations will continually drink. And they will drink and swallow and become as if they had never existed. That has foreshadows, echoes of everything Daniel has told us about Christ and his stone kingdom coming back to crush all the kingdoms of this world and grind them to powder as he sets up his kingdom that will never end. Same language here. It will be as if they never existed. Verse 17. But on Mount Zion, that's Jerusalem, on Mount Zion, there will be those who escape, and it, Jerusalem, will be holy, and the house of Jacob will possess their possessions. And then the house of Jacob will be a fire. This is the language we looked at in Zechariah. And the house of Joseph, the northern tribes, will be a flame. But the house of Esau will be as stubble. Well, Zechariah said that Israel was going to be like a fire among stubble. Now we know what he was referring to. The house of Esau will be as stubble, and they will set them on fire and consume them, so that there will be no survivor of the house of Esau. Repeatedly now, Obadiah has said it's going to be a complete destruction, a complete wipeout of these ancient enemies of Israel. And why? For the Lord Yahweh has spoken. Then those of the Negev, that's the southern area below Jerusalem, will possess the mountain of Esau. And those of the Shephelah, which is the plains area, the Philistine plain, also will possess the territory of Ephraim and the territory of Samaria. And Benjamin will possess Gilead. And the exiles of this host of the sons of Israel, who are among the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem, who are in Sepharad, will possess the cities of the Negev. The deliverers will ascend on Mount Zion to judge the mountain of Esau, and that kingdom will be Yahweh's. Okay, so that's the 21 verses from Obadiah, but he agrees completely with everything we've seen from Jeremiah, everything we've been seeing from Zechariah. When I say the prophets of the Old Testament all speak with one voice, this is the kind of thing I'm saying. They all say that ultimately God is going to judge the nations of the earth that have come up against Israel, and he is going to restore Israel, regather Israel, and give them the land that he originally promised to Abraham that's going to reach all the way out to the Euphrates River and all the way down to the Nile. Okay, well, that's the ultimate Abrahamic promise, and here Obadiah starts saying that those areas that belong to the Philistines, those areas that belong to the Edomites, are ultimately going to be owned by Israel, by Benjamin, by the sons of Joseph. Okay, so with that background, now let's turn to Zechariah. That was indeed all introduction, and tonight we will look at Zechariah 13.
Question.
Yeah.
What you have read from the NASB, I guess, differs radically from the ESV in the tense.
Really?
Yeah, if you were talking about future, they talked about past, and vice versa. And it really changes what you read.
To some degree, as I said, when we're talking about the Nabataeans or the Romans ultimately destroying Edom, that has happened in our past, but it was future to Obadiah.
Right. But like I said, not all of the tense is always off, but much of what you read is different from what ESV translates in the terms of tense.
Don't remember, Hebrew only has two tenses.
Right.
Present and past.
Yep.
And your perspective is how you're going to translate it into English. This is what's going to happen to Edom, because it hasn't happened yet when Obadiah writes.
Right.
But it is certain as if it had already happened.
You know, I think what Steve is getting at, if I can piggyback off your comment, is the prophets speak as if these things have already happened. Like the Lord declares the destruction of Edom. It hadn't happened yet, but it's so certain to happen that God speaks it in the present tense. And so that being the case, the ESV may have gone with that present tense instead of a future tense, but when we're reading it in English and we know that it's prophetic of things that are going to happen, they then add that future tense to it.
Now,
or
said,
emphasize, not
you
add.
You said Hebrew has past and present, but it doesn't
so
have
they,
future.
When they speak to the future, you have to look to interpret that basically from the message, from the context, what the author's trying to present, etc. So prophetically, the vast majority of prophetic literature is speaking of what is going to take place sometime in the future of the person who speaks those words. Sometimes the prophets speak to the situation as it exists and say, this is the word of the Lord, this is what you've done, and therefore, you know, you haven't built the temple. You've come back to the land, you haven't built the temple. You haven't built the wall in Nehemiah's day. So that's present and somewhat past tense. But when the prophets are speaking, they don't really have, and you know, no Hebrew in that day would have ever had any trouble interpreting this because it was so clear to them. We have to go from English, which has multiple tenses.
And the ESV translators may have very well seeing that present tense language in the Hebrew, trying to be literal in their interpretation, may have stayed with that. Whereas the NASB translators, knowing that it was about the future, would put it in a future tense.
Okay.
Oh, I got an okay out of him, so I guess we're good. And with that introduction, Zechariah 13. Good questions, good answers. In that day, well, then we have to answer the question, in what day? Look at verse 9 of the previous chapter, Zechariah 12, 9. And in that day I will set about to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. That's what we were just reading about in Obadiah. I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn. And in that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem, like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. And the land will mourn, and every family by itself. Chapter 13, verse 1, and in that day. So during this time, when Christ returns, when his feet touch the Mount of Olives, when Israel recognizes their Messiah, the one whom they have pierced, in that day, a fountain will be opened for the house of David and for the inhabitants of Jerusalem, a fountain for sin and for impurity. Okay, well then when Christ comes back and they recognize who he is because he has given them that spirit of supplication so that they will look on him whom they have pierced, in that day God will also provide them cleansing from their sins. So despite the fact that we could certainly argue that Israel has been rebellious, though we could certainly argue that, yes, they killed their Messiah, though we can say, yes, they have broken the law of God, and yes, they have continued in their hard-hearted ways all these years, we would still have to admit that in that day, when Christ comes back to establish his kingdom, when he rules on David's throne from Jerusalem, that he is going to create a fountain for the cleansing of Israel and the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the house of David for their sin and for their impurity. So God's got it all covered. And all of the human reasoning and excuses for why God can't reestablish Israel fade away in light of what the Bible actually says. He's going to solve their sin problem the same way that he solved your sin problem. And it will come about, says verse 2. It will come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land. Oh yeah, Israel has a long, long history of idol worship going all the way back to the first time that they inhabited the land of Canaan, and there was the break between the northern and the southern tribes. And Jeroboam, their first king, led them into idol worship in the groves and on the high hills. So what's God going to do about it? Notice that Israel isn't the one who are going to fix it. Israel is not going to recognize their own rebellion against God and clean up their act. It is God himself who is going to forgive them and restore them and change their behavior, because it'll come about in that day, declares the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies, that I will cut off the names of the idols from the land, and they will no longer be remembered. I'm going to wipe them out completely, and I will also remove the prophets and the unclean spirit from the land. As you're going to see in a moment, that's obviously a reference to the false prophets, the prophets who have said things to Israel that were contrary to what God has said through his true prophets. We saw a lot of that in the book of Jeremiah. So much so that people aren't going to want to say that they are a prophet, says verse 3. And if anyone still prophesies, then his father and mother who gave birth to him will say to him, you shall not live, for you have spoken falsely in the name of Yahweh. And his father and mother who gave birth to him will pierce him through when he prophesies. So not only is God going to cut off the idols, he's going to cut off the false prophets. And if anybody prophesies falsely about God, their own parents are going to be responsible for putting them to death. Verse 4, also, it will come about in that day that the prophets will each be ashamed of his vision when he prophesies. And they will not put on a hairy robe in order to deceive. That's a reference, obviously, to Elijah or even John the Baptist, that they wore these coats of hair as part of their station as a prophet. And so those people who want to put on as if they are prophets aren't going to do that anymore. They're not going to put that hairy robe on in order to deceive the people, to convince them that they are prophets. Instead, what he's going to say, according to verse 5, is he will say, no, I'm not a prophet. No, I'm a tiller of the ground. I'm a farmer. For a man sold me as a slave in my youth. I'm not a prophet. I'm just a tiller of the ground. And no one will say to him, what are these wounds between your arms? That means wounds on your chest or on your back. I don't know if any of you have seen the videos in the Middle East to this very day of the Islamic folk who will beat themselves across the back and leave stripes across their back, or they even use swords to cut their own heads so that they bleed for their gods. That kind of Middle Eastern behavior was typical also of the prophets who would try to gain the sympathy of the people, try to prove that they were prophets. And instead, when people come to them and say, what are these wounds? Because these are typically the wounds of a prophet. They'll say, no. I was wounded in the house of my friends. I didn't do this to myself. Some buddies of mine did this to me. So they're absolutely going to deny that they are false prophets. But then starting at verse 7, once again, God's perspective turns to his Messiah, turns to the Christ, the very one who Zechariah has already told us is going to come riding on a donkey. And in his first incarnation, he satisfied that. He fulfilled that. But then he is going to be cut off. And we even read the price of the silver that is going to be paid for the death of the Messiah, for the information leading to Christ so that he could be crucified. So he was cut off from his people, but then he's going to return, and when he returns, the people are going to recognize the Messiah whom they have pierced. And verse 7, again, is talking about what's going to happen when that Messiah comes to the planet and is cut off by the people. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man, my associate, my close one, the one that's right here beside me, declares the Lord of hosts. So it's his shepherd, it is his man, it is his close associate. And yet he says, awake, O sword, against my shepherd. Strike the shepherd, that the sheep may be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones. Not only when Christ was killed did his 12 apostles scatter, but then come 70 AD and everything that he predicted about the destruction of the temple and not one stone being left on another, but then the Jews were scattered out of their land one more time. That all happened. That's historic reality, that when the shepherd was struck, the sheep scattered. And then God will turn his hand against those, against the Israelites, against those that belong to him. And it will come about in all the land, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish, but a third will be left in it. That's the same thing we read in the book of Revelation, that two-thirds of Israel was going to be destroyed, but a third of it was going to continue, because when Christ returns, he's going to cut those days short, or else no flesh would continue. Well, that's something that Zechariah has already predicted here, that it's going to come about in all the land, that two-thirds that are in it will be cut off and perish, but a third will be left in it. And what is he going to do with that remnant that's left over? And I will bring the third part through the fire, through that time of Jacob's trouble, through that time of trouble such as never was or ever would be again. I will refine them as I take them through that time of my wrath and preserve them. I will bring the third part through the fire. I will refine them as silver is refined, and I will test them as gold is tested. They will call on my name. I have to ask, in the midst of all this, so far in everything we have read about the prophecy of Zechariah of Christ returning, the nations being punished, Israel being regathered, the kingdom being established, Jesus sitting on David's throne, and then the refining of Israel, making them a holy people, creating Jerusalem holy again, and then them ultimately calling on his name, and he is going to answer them. Through all of that, who's the actor? It's always God. This is God saying in advance, this is what I'm going to do. And he began in his relationship with Israel by saying, I didn't choose you because you were the best people. I didn't choose you because you were the greatest people. He's doing all this as a demonstration of his grace, of his faithfulness, of the consistency of his promises, and his own faithfulness to his own covenants, to his own people. He is ultimately the eschatological end of humankind on planet Earth, is God doing everything that he promised back in the book of Genesis, and reestablishing his own people to the point where they will call on him, because he's going to get rid of their idols. He's going to clean them. He's going to refine them. He's going to make them a holy and a righteous people who then will call on the name of Yahweh, and he is going to answer them. And I will say, they are my people. Now, we have not looked in this particular study of the minor prophets. We have not yet looked at Hosea. But I have taught about Hosea in the past, and you should all be familiar with Hosea. But Hosea and his wife of whoredoms, Gomer, their children had the particular names of Jezreel and then Lo-Ami and Lo-Ruhamah, not my people, and no mercy. And the very people, according to Hosea, who were told they are not my people and God is not merciful to them, will ultimately receive the mercy of God and will be called my people. Same thing Zechariah is saying here. Ultimately, those scattered ones, ultimately those that have gone through the punishment of God, ultimately, those who he has declared as not my people will end up being my people. Israel, the very same people group who are descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the very ones who have the covenant promises, the very ones through whom the Messiah comes, are the very ones who in the end of everything wind up being the holy, righteous, collective people of God, my people. That's the big plan. And they will say, Yahweh is my God. Okay, so why are they going to say that? Why are they going to come to that conclusion? Why is all of that going to happen? It's all going to happen because God, and because God's sovereign, and because he says in advance what it is he's going to do. and what he is going to do consistently through all the prophets. Have you noticed how often we've been able to flip back and forth between these various prophets and see them saying the same thing about the same people, about the same God, and coming to the same conclusion? And that conclusion is Israel belongs to God and will ultimately be his people. He will be their God. Jerusalem will be his holy place. Jesus is going to sit on the throne of David, ruling from Jerusalem. The Gentile nations that have ever come against Israel are ultimately going to be destroyed. That's the same message that we saw in the book of Revelation. And the kingdom that is coming is a kingdom that is never going to end. And that's the story of the Bible. The great redemptive history and story of the Bible is God's faithfulness to his people. And in the midst of all that, he also came and got you. But what he's doing right now is working out his big plan for everything. And you can look at the world, and you can look at the Middle East, and you can look at the trouble that's brewing in the world even now, that Jesus said are just the birth pangs. It's not the end yet, but it's coming. And this is going to continue to ramp up because it is inevitable that one day God is going to bring about this time of destruction such as never was or ever would be again. And that Christ is going to come and get his church. And that we are going to return with him, the 10,000s of his saints that Jude talks about. All I'm saying is the Bible only tells one story. It's a very consistent story, and it is a story of sovereignty and grace.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, articles, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.